Okay.
Happy anniversary! Wow, wonderful, Mazel Tov.
Thank you.
You're 3 years married?
actually, it's been, this will be 19.
19? Oh, 19. That's beautiful. Beautiful. Glorious years. Many, many, many more. Happy and healthy ones.
Thank you.
So how are we from last week's class? Any questions since we discussed it?
No, I don't think we had any here.
Okay. Mr. Cole, I'm trying to recall the okay. So why don't we go back? Let's get resume now on Kehelis. We finished up, I think, we wanted to do. On the we were doing Tefillin last week, if I was right.
Tefillin?
What was the I'm trying to remember what was the main question that we had last week.
We were talking about the plagues.
Oh, the plagues. Right. Yeah.
So you were looking at the reason behind each one.
Right. All right, so subsequent to that, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. He was telling me that one day this week, he didn't make it to the temple for the morning davening, morning prayers. So he was davening, he was praying at home, and he's putting on his tefillin, you know, the black boxes that we wear in the head and the arm, and he was wondering what the concept was. And we actually took a look, and it's in last week's the section that we read last week. And it's amazing how you can go back over the same text and discover new things. It's like you never even read it before. It's just, I guess, because whenever you read something the first time and something catches your focus, so that's what you focus on, and you don't really take note of all the other areas that are just waiting to be discovered. I think also part of the problem is that people read it, and myself included, and then you categorize certain things as just, you know, not as important as other things. But if we revamp that attitude and say that every verse, there has to be a tremendous amount of knowledge. So then when you read a verse, that typically you'd say, well, you know, it's just background information, or it's very simple, how much could this verse, these few words, be telling you? But if you revamp that view, there can be a tremendous amount of information that you can derive from there. And one example was, we were looking at the verses last week regarding the tefillin. So that's really, you know, where the tefillin originate. And there's four sections of the tefillin. Two of them come from last week's Torah reading, because it refers to the tefillin itself in the Torah. And then God's telling the Jews that they should, you know, due to the plague of the firstborns, so the Jews were saved. So as a response to that, the Jews now have to redeem the firstborn child. And they also have to redeem the firstborn animal, because God also smote the firstborn animal in Egypt in the last plague. So it's a funny type of thing. The other plagues didn't have any response, really, that you had to... That God just did that, he performed the plague, and that was it. But here, the Jews have to respond with an eternal command, and that's redeeming the firstborn, and also writing this down. This whole section is written down in the tefillin that we wear. And it's, the actual source is, it's chapter 13, Exodus, where God says to sanctify the first issue that comes out of the womb of man and animal. Or is that a direct response to the fact that these were saved of the Jews? Um, The reason given is in verse 3. It's chapter 13, verse 3, where Moses tells the people to remember this day that you're leaving Egypt from the house of slaves. For with a strong hand did God take you out of here. Right, so it's telling you, with a strong hand. Now, if you skip to the very last verse of this section of this parsha bo, it says again. Give me one second. If you take a look at 13:9. All right, you have a second instance where it says it'll be for a sign on your hands and for a remembrance between your eyes, in order that the teaching of God will be in your mouth, because with a strong hand did God take you out. Again, biyad chazaka, a strong hand is mentioned. And the very last verse, which is 13:16, it refers to the tefillin again. It'll be for a sign on your hand and for frontlets between your eyes, for with a strong hand did God take you out of Mitzrayim. Did God take us out of Egypt.
Really?
Yes.
So, I take it that verse 9 and 16 are the first time that we hear about the tefillin?
Exactly.
And I notice both say, I mean, there's two mentions in each one. It seems like in both places, the first one is sign upon your arm, which I assume is the same Hebrew word. But the second one seems to be different.
That's right. Right, letotophos is used the second time. It's not used the first time. That's right.
And I would be very interested in how the sages get from those words to black boxes with long leather straps.
Well, that's part of the oral law.
Oh, okay. So that was directly given then. Not that they derived it should look like that, but that was directly given to Moses that this is what it looks like?
Exactly. Right. I mean, all the details, that they have to be square. I think the Talmud even says that it doesn't even have to be black. I think only that it has to be that the straps are the same color as the box. I think theoretically, if you wanted to have green tefillin, it would be fine. I'm not sure in terms of how the final ruling or what customs might come into play now as a determination. But the interesting thing is just the phenomena itself. Many times when you do something over and over again, and tefillin is something which your child is doing from when he becomes a teen, and then in the last month or so of his being 12 years old, he starts putting on these tefillin. And then you just do it every single day. Things that are so rote, we tend just to never examine. But the truth is, it's such an important lesson over here that this is now a direct response to the last plague, and that God keeps on repeating three times, because of a strong hand, God took you out of Egypt. So what is so significant that you have to tell me? I mean, he used a strong hand, so to speak, by all the plagues. But it's singled out over here by the last plague, and there has to be some significance there in terms of why that is reiterated, and then why the tefillin now becomes an essential thing, that actually the real law is to wear it on our bodies all the time, not just as we do today for the morning and then take them off. And what are we actually reading in the tefillin? So you have these two areas. One is about the initial response of redeeming the firstborn, and the second area is so that's right here. That's 13, chapter 13. And the next area is what butts right up to this, and that's 13:11, the very next section, which tells you that when you come into the land, that you'll continue this practice of redeeming the firstborn. and referring to the tefillin a second time. So that's those are two out of the four sections they have the tefillin. The last two sections they have in the tefillin, because each one of the black boxes, both the arm and the one on the head, have four different sections. So you have what I just recited, those two, and then you have in the Shema prayer, we put in those first two paragraphs. So that makes up the four sections of the tefillin. So then it's interesting that the tefillin really, the primary focus is this recollection of the last plague and the law of redeeming the firstborn, and actually reflecting on the very tefillin itself by including the command. And then we talk about God's unity in the Shema, that God is one, and the ideas of reward and punishment. So, you know, as we got into it, I was discussing this with my friends, so we were exploring it, and it's, you know, a very interesting thing. But I'll open it up to you to maybe think about it for a moment, take a look at the verses here, and see if you have any insight. And again, I want to do this area instead of Koheles, because I want to keep my promise from last week that there was a 50% chance that we would not do Koheles.
Very good.
That works.
Mm-hmm. Works to me. Where can we find... Rabbi, where can we find it that explains that it should be the straps? Where did you say we could find that?
Well, that's in the Talmud. I don't know offhand. I had looked at it many years ago. I can locate that for you, though. I'll let you know what that is.
But what's interesting, and I wanted to ask this question, Rabbi, if I may. What's interesting is that with the film, the straps are put on the left hand, yet when we speak about the strength of Hashem's hand, we refer to the right hand.
Well, right, because the straps were not...
Is there an explanation somewhere about that as well?
Yeah, we're not... I don't think that we're making any equation between God's mighty hand and the hand that we put the tefillin on. There's not... We're not... God's hand is one thing, and the fact that tefillin is put on the hand is really so that the box itself should be across from the heart. So the hand, I think, is more...
See, this is what I was thinking. My next question, beautiful. That it should be close to the heart.
Right, because what you're showing is that you're
saying... On the arm that's closest to the heart, that has significance, just as the box is put on the forehead between the eyes at a certain spot. It can't be too far back. It can't be too far forward. There's a certain... It's supposed to penetrate the brain, I think, at a certain point. I'm not sure where I heard it. I remember hearing it somewhere. I don't know from which rabbi or how I heard it, but it had significance that it's placed at a certain part. Am I saying something that everybody knows about? Is it because I'm not clear on it?
No, that's true. It has to be placed in a precise location.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Everything is precise.
Yep.
Everything is so precise. Nothing is by accident. It's so fascinating.
Rabbi, with regard to the three statements of a strong hand, I mean, it would seem, generally speaking, when you repeat something, you repeat it because it's important and it has important significance. So is this potentially three times reminder that the only reason, Israel, you are a free people is because Hashem brought you out of Egypt, and that you need to constantly be reminded of that, lest you kind of fall into the forgetfulness? I mean, when somebody's in one condition of life and then they move to another condition, it's very easy after a while to, as you alluded to before, to just get very complacent about, oh yeah, life's always been like that, and maybe this is a constant reminder that, you need to continually think about the fact that I brought you out.
And what would be the significance of the strong hand, that aspect of it?
That, my best shot would be that you didn't just kind of get out by circumstance or by a fluke of a couple of economic things coming together or something that could be explained away, but the hand of Hashem was so strong, or the demonstration of the plagues and the way that you left was so strong that there can be no doubt that it was specifically because Hashem decreed it.
Okay. So that's what strong hand means. That it's
that's my best shot at strong hand.
Uh-huh. And what could that be in contrast to? God's strong hand in contrast to what? And why is it strong hand in connection to the last plague, and we don't see that so emphasized by the previous nine?
Is the connection? What's the connection to the last plague? Oh, because of what's in 13:1.
Hold on, I'm the one that gets to ask the questions here.
I'm just trying to assess the fact. You said there was a connection.
Right, but that's the actual question. That's where the answer is going to come.
Well, okay, so I'm confused.
Okay.
You're saying there is a connection.
It's only because I see, like, these three times over here, it's mentioning the strong hand in connection with the last plague, the firstborn deaths, and you don't see that by the previous plague, so...
Right, so I'm just trying to establish, when you say that we're in connection with the firstborn deaths, where's the connection?
Oh, because it's not mentioned until afterwards, but God says with a strong hand, He took you out of Egypt. That's only subsequent to again, it's a good question. Like, I'm suggesting that it's, since it's right on the heels of the firstborn, and it's talking about the redeeming of our firstborns, and that's where the strong hand is put together. For example, chapter 13. So God says to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me the firstborn of anything which comes forth from the womb first." Whether it be animal or beast, man or beast. And Moses told the people that remember this day that you're coming out of Egypt from the house of slaves, for with a strong hand they're going to take you out from here. All right? And then he says in 9 that it'll be a sign on your hands, and he goes on and says, because with a strong hand he took you out. So the strong hand is subsequent to the firstborn, and it's you know, spoken about let's see if I can give you a clear Yeah, you see in verse, for example, 15. And when you're telling it over to your child, so Moses tells the people, and it was that when Paro was stubborn, and he refused to send out, so God killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of man to the firstborn of the animal. Therefore, I slaughter the firstborn that comes out of the males, to God, and all the firstborn of my sons I will redeem. And this will be a sign on your hand and frontlets between your eyes. For with a strong hand, God took us out of Egypt. So it seems to be the strong hand is directly following the practice of redeeming the firstborn, which is a reflection of that plague.
I hear you. I'll accept the connection because I... suspect that you have a purpose for asking. I would probably argue that the strong hand removed us refers to all of those, and that what's being referred to there is just the commandment to, in 13:1, to sanctify every firstborn. But let's go down your path here.
Let's also consider something else, that what we're putting into the tefillin is not only this discussion about these two chapters right here, these two sections. You know, a section in the Torah is marked off by either a... there's a gap of letters in the actual Torah script to indicate that now a section has been completed, and there's a gap of 9 letters or so on, and then it picks up like 9 letters later. So this is when you actually look at the Torah text, you see a gap that indicates that now this is a discrete concept. So that first discrete concept of what we call a section, a parsha, so that was chapter 13 through verse 10, so 10 verses. Then the second, that's the first part that's put into the tefillin. The second part that's put in is starting with the verse 11 and going to the end of the actual section. Okay? those are two sections. And then we have, again, the Shema, which talks about loving God with all your heart, your soul, and your might. That's the third section. And then the fourth section of the tefillin is, talks about when you come into land. If you certainly listen to the commands, you'll have the rain and the due season and so on, but don't chase after the idols, and it talks about reward and punishment. And then it refers again to tefillin, and to tzitzis and to mezuzah. So those are the four sections. So we have to understand what the Shema has to do. Shema is really not mentioned anywhere here, and this is where the inception of the tefillin come about. So whenever something, it's a very important rule that when something is mentioned for the first time, and that's really the inception of the phenomena, so that's really the defining content. And you see that Shema is not here when we first start talking about the tefillin. So we have to look at these verses to tell us what the real definition is. And also, again, keeping in mind this thing about the strong hand and why it's not mentioned by the other plagues and what this concept is about the redemption of the firstborn. So there's a number of ideas here that we're touching on, and there may be, we have to try to do is see if we can pull them together. So while I give you, think about it for a moment, then we'll see if we can try to address these subtle clues that the Torah is offering us. But you see that the repetition again, many times over the past few weeks, I think I've mentioned that the Torah uses repetition to call your attention to something. It makes you aware of a theme.
Is it possible that the strong hand, you asked the question earlier, what's that as opposed to? Could it be as opposed to the weak or ineffectual idolatry of the Egyptians?
Excellent. Exactly.
So they tried all their stuff and
they couldn't
do much, if anything.
Yeah, that was actually Josh's question about why it says that when they tried to perform lice and they couldn't do it, it says again that the lice was on the beast and on man. It said that the previous verse. It says that Moses and Aaron hit the sand of Egypt and the lice was on beast and man. Then the astrologers tried to do it and they couldn't, and the lice was on beast and man. So we already know that. What I suggested to last week was that it's showing you that the status quo had been unchanged by the astrologers. It was trying to show how ineffective they were, like you're saying right now. So repeating something exactly as it was in the previous verse comes to tell you nothing changed. So that's really the point. Now, what God is doing when he says that with a strong hand, that means God is, in contrast to the Egyptians, there was no power whatsoever. And we have support for this because we see that in Ezekiel, I think it is chapter 20, and you look over there, chapter 20, maybe verse 5, somewhere around there, it says that God was going to kill the Jews in Egypt, but he didn't for one reason, because he made a promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob that he's going to take them into the land. But really, of their own merit, since they had assimilated into the idolatrous culture, they weren't worthy on their own merit of being saved. So now if we start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, we see that as they're leaving, Rabbi Trait made a beautiful point on this years ago, that the Jewish nation had to emerge as in a state of redemption. They couldn't just go from slavery to freedom, because that was not the objective. The objective was not that you shouldn't be a slave. That's not the whole goal in life, that you should not have a slave. So now you're free. So that's the whole objective in life? No, the objective is that you're created with intelligence in order to pursue knowledge of the Creator and to enjoy this amazing reality of the universe having a Creator. It's just, if we take time to ponder it, it is a very amazing thing that He is the sole cause of the entire universe, and there's nothing else. And I believe that's the point of the mighty hand, the strong hand, that's trying to teach this lesson as they're leaving Egypt, and they were all involved in idolatry. The only way that you have a right to existence is if you accept the reality that you had denied all this time. You thought there were these sub-deities. You thought that's how the reality exists. Well, that's not true. Reality is that there's only one cause, and that was the demonstration of all the plagues and the control over nature. But now, as the Jews emerge, the Jewish nation, as it's coming about at this point, it has to emerge simultaneously as a redeemed people, meaning the Jewish people have the identity as being subservient to God. There's no such concept that they went to a state of freedom and then later on they started following God. No. The very identity of the people had to be stamped upon them as they were being forged. You cannot have the concept of the Jewish people and that's separate at any moment from God. So the subservience to God has to be there as soon as they emerge. So they're emerging as a redeemed people. Redeemed in the sense that they have to recall this event and accept God as they're abandoning the idolatry. It's not enough just to abandon idolatry. But the only thing is, the only way to really abandon idolatry is with the knowledge, the true knowledge. So the mighty hand was necessary in terms of causing the people to emerge as the people that recognize God and are subservient to Him. And the way they would know that is by seeing that He has the might and nothing else does. So that was the transition. That's what the mighty hand is for. And very interesting too, which I think complements this idea, is that the idea of tefillin, that it has to be on the body always, it demonstrates that the human being, like the Talmud says, a metaphor, says the human being is diseased. It has like a wound on it. But there is a bandage. And if you put the bandage on, you'll be healthy, you'll be restored. And that bandage is the Torah. So what that means is that the human being, bereft of any involvement of Torah, which means the pursuit of God, so if a human being does not pursue God, so he's going to be a sick creature. He is not independent. He is not complete. You may think he is because he seems to be able to eat and be healthy and function independently, but that only comes in the physical realm. But it's only half of the being. So having tefillin on the body demonstrates that the body, the human being, is incomplete without this appendage. So that's what tefillin really demonstrate. The Jews, when they're leaving, and they're the reason why the tefillin is immediate upon their release is to demonstrate that without it, you're going to be like a sick creature. So there has to be this constant reminder. And it's on the body itself because it's like synonymous with the essentiality of the limbs.
I think that's a fantastic insight. That is.
Yeah,
thank you, Rabbi.
Sure.
it makes, even though I'm not a man and I don't put on tefillin, I can see what you said before about the Torah being a bandage, because none of us are perfect, and we are in a sense sick to some degree, and the Torah gives us a refuah, a healing. I see it. I see it in my own personal life. I see it when I witness other people, and I believe that to be so true.
Right.
Thank you for bringing it to the point.
My pleasure. It's a real important lesson.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Rabbi, just to clarify, it's the understanding that the human being is incomplete without, or is it? He's incomplete without the pursuit of the understanding of God.
Well, not only incomplete, but without following the intelligence and reality and starting off with the fact that there's a creator and that being the primary concept. So then, it's not only that he's incomplete, but he's going to be corrupt. Because then, all that he has left to function are the instinctual drives, and that's what Egypt was. If that's something which is not part of a human being's existence, so then you'll end up like in the Egyptian culture. That's what it means that the human being is sick. He has only two paths he can go down: an intelligent path or an emotional path. Now, of course, the emotions are essential. That's what God gave us, the emotions, but they have to be under the direction of the intelligence.
And Rabbi, please, could I ask, the Torah represents truth. Could we say that if there's no truth, then there has to be corruption?
Yes.
Would you say that?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
So that in terms of the Shema, now we could perhaps answer why the Shema is also included in the tefillin, because now that we're saying that the tefillin have to recall God's might and that we should be on the defensive, see, really the tefillin are defensive measures, that we should recall that there was only one force, and that was God in Egypt. So that's the mighty hand. That's why he keeps on talking about that. like you said, Doug, the contrast, the ineptitude of the Egyptians. But now, as we clarify that, so the Shema comes in and elaborates that God is one. That this force, and this only force in Egypt that did all these plagues and killed the firstborn, so now we complement this very message by adding on two more sections in the tefillin that, of course, refer to the tefillin, but the concept of God's exclusivity. And leaving the Egyptian culture, we could see why tefillin came about at this point. This was as they were very, this is the very point that they're leaving and they're transitioning into the right life. So now there must be something which ensures this. So you see now how the Shema fits in with the tefillin.
So is the purpose of saying strong hand three times to just emphasize this point?
I don't know why three. I can tell you why two, because the two sections, one's talking about the initial command. The second one talks about when you come into the land, meaning that it should now be a perpetual command. So that's what 13:11 says, and it'll be when you come into the land. And you should continue this practice of redeeming the firstborn. From the first instance, you don't see that as a command. Here's what you're saying. Well, you could say that it is there as well, because it says in 13, 8, that you should tell it on your son on that day. Because of this, God took me out of Mitzrayim. I mean, because of the matzah. That's what it's referring to there. Now that matzah, there were really two matzahs, you have to realize. There was the matzah that they ate the whole time in Egypt. The Egyptians were the, as Jorachet taught, were the inventors of bread. But they didn't give the bread, the nice, luxurious food, to their slaves. They gave them the poor man's bread, so that's what we ate. But then there was the night that we were finally freed. We had the Paschal lamb. So it says that as the firstborns were being killed in Egypt, all of Egypt came and ousted the Jews because they were terrified that not only the firstborns would die, but that everybody would die. So it said the Jews grabbed the dough that they had on their kneading troughs, and they left. The question is, why were they all making dough that night? And also, why were they only grabbing the dough to leave? They didn't grab anything else. It would seem to me, and why did God retard the rising of the dough that they wrapped up in their clothing? So this woman, they finally got, I think, the Sukkos, the first point, so they made the matzahs at that point after they left Egypt, because since the dough didn't have a chance to rise because they were ousted so quickly, they couldn't bake it into anything but matzah. It couldn't rise. Since the dough didn't rise because of the speed of the Exodus, so when they actually baked it, it only turned into matzah. It couldn't turn into bread. But I believe that's all part of the design, and that's the real matzah that's referring to, meaning the Jews envied the Egyptians being their masters, and I believe that they wanted to have a little taste of that bread that they saw that they couldn't have those hundreds of years. So as they finally had the release from their masters, they now wanted to have that type of a expression of freedom, but that's something which God didn't allow. He didn't allow them to do something which had a similarity of just freedom that expressed by the Egyptians, because Egyptians didn't follow God. So had the Jews been able to make this dough, let it rise, and have bread, then that would have been a wrong value, meaning to enjoy just free man's bread, because it's not, the goal was not to be free. The goal was now to leave servitude of Egypt and take on the servitude of God. So God did not allow them to have any type of semblance of the Egyptian freedom, which is expressed by that icon, that bread, that nice risen bread. So he rushed them out. He didn't allow the dough to rise. And then when we eat it later on on Passover, it's to recollect that point, that fundamental. Not just that we were ousted so quickly, but that we were not to be transitioning from slaves just to purely free people. The bread would have embodied that. So God didn't allow them to have that. That would not be constructive. So therefore we eat the bread to recognize that we eat the matzah, to recognize that our release was to become subservient to God, not to have a similitude of complete freedom like an Egyptian people that had no master, because bread would have embodied that, and that's the wrong idea. God did not want them to parallel in their minds any type of, he didn't want them to parallel the Egyptians in any way. So had they been able to make this bread and enjoy it and, revel in the fact that now we're free, we're just like the Egyptians, that would be a wrong concept. You can't allow them to have the thought that we're just like the Egyptians, free now. And that's not why you're being freed. So the matzah is really what teaches that. That's why it's so significant that you'll tell over to your son that day. Where is that again?
Verse 8.
And you'll tell to your son that day because of this. And the rabbis say, what do you mean this? Because of the matzah. You're supposed to point to the matzah when you say those words, because of this. Meaning pointing at the matzah, did God do this for me? Meaning because, what do you mean the matzah? Because of the servitude to God. That's what the matzah represents. So because of this, God took us out. Because we now are going to take on a life of following God. That's the whole reason why we were taken out. So we have to tell our children, that's why we were taken out. Because of this, what the matzah represents. It represents a transition from slavery to the Egyptians to a slavery to God. And there was never any chance that we had to be like the Egyptians, free of of an Egyptian master and free of God. That is no good. You see that?
Oh, that's beautiful. It's no longer the bread of affliction. It's now the, so to speak, the bread of servitude to God.
We, right.
We're choosing this. We're making that transition.
Right.
But the matzah now has a whole different...
yeah, it's redefined. It's redefined now.
Yeah, redefined. Exactly. That's the word I couldn't find. Right. Thank you. Oh, that's great.
Now, let's see. Now, Doug's question... Your question, Doug, was, do you see, a second. Yeah, just tell me the question you had again just now, Doug.
The three reason times. That it was mentioned twice?
Right, the three times, actually. The three times.
Yeah, the strong hand mentioned three, and then the follow-up question would be the tefillin mentioned twice.
Right. Okay. So the first time Strong has mentioned, that is in 13:3. Okay. Who's speaking here?
Moses.
No. One second. God is speaking to Moses, and he tells them, "Kadosh, you know, sanctify the firstborn." Remember this day. So then Moses starts speaking. Remember this day, and he sees the concept right away. See, Moses is right in tune with what God is doing. So these are actually his insights. And he says, because with a strong hand, doesn't seem that God told him to say this. Moses saw this. So with a strong hand, God take you from here, and you should not eat any leaven. See, it's such a significant factor. Okay. So that's important in and of itself in terms of the matzah. So maybe why it's three times is because the strong hand, it has to be talked about in connection with the matzah. It also has to be talked about in connection with the tefillin. And you have two separate parshas, two separate sections of the tefillin. So therefore, you have to have two more mentions. But you see, the strong hand is essential because that is the real fundamental here. That's the core idea, is that God is contrasting his strong hand with the ineptitude of the Egyptian magicians and all the gods of Egypt. As a matter of fact, Rashi states, to our point, that when God killed all the firstborns, he also, all the idols were destroyed as part of the miracle. If they were metal, they melted. If they were wooden idols, they rotted. Right, I believe that's where.
Really?
Yeah. When did that happen?
Yeah, I'll show you. One second.
I never knew that, Rabbi.
Yes, very good. Yeah, thank you. 12:12.
12:12.
Right, that's 12:12, where he says that I will pass through Egypt that night, and I will smite all the firstborn of Egypt, from man to animal, and of all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am God. All right? You see the point at the end of the pasuk. The end of the verse says, I'm going to execute judgments. What's the whole point? To show that I am God. The very last two words of 12:12. You see, it sums up what the objective is, and it's exactly in line with what we're saying. And Rashi says, on all the gods of Egypt, on that headline in the verse, so Rashi comments, if it was, the god was of wood, it would rot. If it was of metal, it would melt. You see that this...
That's in Rashi?
Yeah, that's Rashi. And that supports our idea that this was a transition. This was the whole transition to actually be the death blow. And it was also very important that this, when God says that he's going to go through the land tonight, he also says that I'm going to go through. As opposed to the other plagues, he doesn't talk about it as being, you know, myself, like a personal type of a plague. But that, what does it mean, personal type of plague? It means in this plague of the death of the firstborns, the mind just could not explain it away naturally. How do you explain a disease that is only attacks those that were born first? Where is the relationship? The fact that somebody was born first is not a natural phenomena, like, you know, having certain type of genes or whatever that the plague would attach to. It's completely an amazing thing. It's just that you can't understand it. And that really shows that it had to be a divine will. So this really brought out this point to the difference.
Okay. I don't have a mighty enough about the idols being melted or destroyed in any way. And that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's Rashi.
Okay, I have to find that.
It's Rashi.
Yeah, I don't have it in my Tanakh.
Okay.
That's really like a real blow. If the proof positive that these are, they're weakling, they could withstand the strength of Hashem.
Right.
They are so-called gods melted before their eyes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
That had to be a good thing for them to say.
Rabbi?
Yes?
For clarification, when you talked about the bread, was the bread that the Jews made, was it only while they were in Egypt enslaved that the bread that they had didn't rise?
Yes.
Or is it that the Jews never had bread that rose?
Well, then, when they were in Egypt as slaves for those hundreds of years, so they were being fed by the Egyptians. I'm sure that the Egyptians just gave them their rations, and that was it. But now, after they had the sacrifice and they were about to leave, you know, the Paschal lamb, so now, for some reason, they all had this dough, which they grabbed as they were being running out, and they wrapped it up in their garments. And the Torah goes out of the way to point to that they're grabbing this dough. It says in 12:34, that the people grabbed their dough, their loaf, the loaf of the dough, before it had risen, from the kneading troughs, and they wrapped it up in their garments and they put them on their shoulders. So it's significant that they're grabbing this. What's also significant is that it talks about the Jews as being believing in God and trusting in Him that He'll provide food in the desert, which seems to imply that they're not taking this dough for the sake of food, even though they do eat it later. But they're all doing this. Why? Nobody commanded them to take this dough and to carry it out.
But doesn't verse 34, when it says they picked up the dough before it could become leavened, imply that, you know, previously they would bake their own stuff and it would be leavened? I mean, if the Egyptians wouldn't give them straw, it's hard for me to imagine they would have handed them bread already made.
Well, what's the significance either way of them, of the Torah telling you at this point that they're grabbing this loaf and the loaf didn't have a chance to rise?
Well, if I was headed out all of a sudden on a trip, I'd probably grab whatever I had that, in terms of food, that was travelable, if I can use that word, so I had something to eat along the way.
Right. Let's see. Rashi that says on this, you take a look at 39. After they traveled, 37, that the Jews traveled from Ramses, which was Ramses, that was in Egypt, and they went to Sukkos. 600,000 men, aside from children. And again, these are the men above 20. And also the mixed multitude ascended with them, and sheep and cattle, and flock, very much. And they baked the loaf, which they took out of Egypt. And I always found it odd. I'll really have to speak to a grammarian about this. But in both cases, when it talks about the loaf, 34 says that the people lifted up his loaf in the singular. The people are plural, all right? it says B'tzeko, it should be B'tzekam. In Hebrew, it should have been with a mem at the end to make it their loaf. But it doesn't. It says his loaf. So they picked up his loaf before it rose. And then, and where did they take it from? From their kneading troughs. And there, the kneading troughs, meaning their kneading troughs, is the right way. It has the mem at the end to imply theirs. And you go back to 39, it says, and the people baked the loaf. Not the loaves, but again, it's like singular, as if it's trying to tell you something. So they baked the loaf, and what did they bake it into? Cakes of, meaning plural. Now it says cakes of matzah. So it's a funny type of thing that it's talking about the loaf in both cases in the singular, which I wanted to suggest a while ago, that you mean that it was a universal identity that they had with this, about that freedom that they wanted to taste. There was a significance here. They all shared that desire to be like the Egyptians. Right? So it says that they baked it into the matzah because it did not become leavened, because Egypt had ousted them out quickly, and they weren't able to tarry. And also, food they did not take with them. What do you mean food they didn't take with them? They took this dough. Rashi says on that, food they didn't take with them. This is now 1239. Rashi says, this tells you the praise of the Jews, that they didn't say, how are we going to go out into the desert without food? But they believed. Meaning they trusted God in terms of the food. So it would seem to be saying, if they trusted God and they didn't take food, so that means the taking of the dough was not for the sake of food. Which again points to what I'm suggesting, that it was for some other reason that they took it. That this symbolized that freedom that was presented to them for all those hundreds of years in Egypt. They just wanted to have a taste of that, you know, finely risen bread. But that was not allowed. They were not allowed to have that. For the reasons that we were suggesting. Now let me see if
Jenny,
go ahead.
Josh, were you going to say something?
No.
Okay, I thought I heard another voice. So I have an aside question. I'm curious as to whether the commentators addressed this. So you have about 2 million people moving out of Egypt into the desert. Now it says they bake the dough. In order to bake the dough, you would have to have a fire.
Yeah.
To have enough firewood for 2 million people to build fires to bake that stuff into matzah, that seems miraculous in itself.
That's a good question.
Particularly because you're in the desert.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if there was, you must say that there was some area where there was enough place to gather some wood. It wasn't completely barren.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some desert terrain is barren. Some desert terrain has, you know, cacti and certain types of trees and all. So it's not completely barren.
Yeah.
It is, it is an interesting thing.
And they did have cattle, too. I don't know if that would be right to do or not, but, I mean, dried cattle dung can be burned.
Ah.
Yeah, that's a point.
Yeah.
There might be other things, too.
Are there any questions up to this point?
I have a question on the film. Is it from the from this point of the Exodus, they were actually commanded to put on the filling, right?
Yeah.
Or were they actually like made and put on at this point?
Well, I can't see that they had the opportunity to do it. But then again, I do not know. I mean, you don't have a record where it says that they actually did this at any point.
So I guess my question is, if it contains the Shema, which is until later, see what I'm saying?
You know, it could have been that was added on, or that was modified at Sinai. That's meaning the rabbis have a phrase that when Sinai, the Torah was given at Sinai, so then all the laws were renewed now. They were revamped. So anything which previously existed, so now there were elaborations on it. For example, circumcision Abraham had, right, long before this. But after Sinai, it was we were taught that you could even do circumcision on the Sabbath. So that we didn't know up to this point. So there were, could be that they did put it on just as these two sections, and after Sinai came along and the oral law was given, it was told that you should also add on the Shema too.
Okay.
Yeah, for example, somebody had a question yesterday, and he said that there's a verse that said, where is it? That they ate. The matzah for 40 years. Let me see what that is. How could they record at that point that they're eating matzah for 40 years? The only mun. It was in the part here. It was talking about the mun. So it says they ate the mun for 40 years, but they were only eating it for 40 years due to the spies. The catastrophe where they were sentenced to dwell in the desert for 40 years, but that didn't happen until much later on. So how could you be telling me right now, as they left Egypt, that they ate this mun when they were in the desert? They were traveling now, so now they needed food. They complained, so God gave them this mun. And then it makes, parenthetically, the Torah tells you that they ate the mun for 40 years. That's sort of like telling them that they don't have a choice. You're going to have to be in the desert for 40 years before they even sinned with the spies? But the Torah, the commentators come right to the point on that, and they say, no, that was inserted later on. They put it, that it didn't happen until later on. So they weren't told at this point. But the Torah, when it writes, so that after the fact, it inserts this. But it wasn't at that time. There was no knowledge that they had at that time that they were going to be eating mun for 40 years, because they didn't sin yet. So as well, in terms of the tefillin, so we look at tefillin today as the final product. But what they had initially could have very well been without the black boxes. I don't know. I don't know what the form was. They did have the command right away, though. That's clear. They're being told right at this point. It could be after the Torah was given, and after the oral law was given to accompany it, then they had the final formulation that we have today. Okay. So far, so good?
Yeah, I see the big picture. It's the details that I have questions about.
Okay, go ahead. Let me hear.
Well, I mean, the one we talked about, you know, firewood and those kinds of things.
Right.
Some of that just seems hard to imagine, although certainly if God can do the 10 plagues, he can manage all those rather smaller details.
Yeah, for sure. But now it gives us a real appreciation for what that film is really all about now.
It seems like that so much of I guess Torah daily life almost
is about reminders of, you know, Hashem and real ideas about Hashem. I mean, the prayers being that, are said three times a day, putting on tefillin to remind you of that, the mezuzah, so many things that are built into daily life.
And you see, it's necessary because without it, look what people turn into. They turn into an Egyptian idolatrous culture. They're no different than we are, you know. I mean, this every human is created with the same exact potential, the same faculties. So if people want to say, oh, you know, idolatry's gone, or this and that, or... No, I mean, we have the same propensity. We just, you know, people tend to look at, you know, prior generations, you know, like they're an archaic thing, they have no relationship to us, it's completely untrue. And the application, the need to remind ourselves about idolatry, and, you know, all of that, you see it's so, you know, prevalent today, you know, the forms of Christianity, even in Judaism, you know, certain ideas that the very, you know, poor thinking Jews project onto Judaism. Deification of people, and you know, we talk about it many times, that the putting notes in the tombs of rabbis, grave sites, and the tendency is very, very strong, and then when a lot of people do it, it seems to endorse it, and people have a hard time disagreeing with the masses, and but initially it's you know, it comes from somewhere. It's no different than the Egyptians, that they buried the pharaohs and the Egyptians and all their possessions and everything because they're, you know, they had this concept of a very tangible, physical, you know, afterlife, and the afterlife is a very, you know, big thing to them. All the same emotions. So you're right. There's so many things that we need to stand guard.
Does that include the custom of slipping notes into between the stones at the Western Wall?
Yes, that's a wrong idea.
Yeah.
Because you see, there's a verse at the end of next week's parsha, which is Yisro, towards the very end. So God says in verse 20:21, Exodus 20:21. He says the words, "In every place that you cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and bless you." God says, "In any place you cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and I will bless you," referring to the different locations of the temple. But the point is that God is aware, He's cognizant of our prayers anywhere we are, whether it's New Jersey or whether it's Israel or anywhere in between. So to think that there's a closer proximity you have by sticking a note in the wall, it goes against this concept. And you're also assuming that there's some proximity physically in terms of God. That's a heretical notion. That this place, and if you want to tell me, well, didn't Jacob say the words, how awesome is this place? So I know, did we take that up?
I do not recall that we did.
Yeah, so... that was on. I did write something on that. If you want to take a look, but the rabbis say on that this idea is a very, very abstract idea, and only those who was told to know it. Meaning the concept of a location, like when God says, for example, to Moses, "Take your shoes off your feet, because the place that you're standing is holy." So Maimonides' son says on that verse that Moses understood that concept. Jacob understood when he had the dream of the ladder. That he was being told something about this location, but Abraham, the son of Maimonides, says only they know the idea because they were told it. We don't. I mean, it's something which is very far, something abstract. Evidently, it's dangerous too, because when you're talking about God and location, those are it's a contradiction. God doesn't take up space. So how can one part of the earth be any more significant than the other part of the earth?
So can I carry that a step further then with regard to the Western Wall? Then is there any, I mean, you know, people to go to that all the time to pray there, is that in itself, the idea that, well, there's something special about going to the Western Wall to pray there, even incorrect? And that it should be just seen as it's a wall, but it's no different a place than any other place.
Yeah, that exactly. It shouldn't be viewed any different. In terms of what God meant to Moses, to take your shoes off your feet because of the place you're standing. Again, that's my mom and his son.
No, but your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
I mean, he says it. Maimonides' son says it. That's a very abstract idea. And he says only those who were told it know it. He says it's evidently there's certain areas that are just off limits. But even Jacob, when he woke up and after the dream of the ladder, and he said, well, how amazing is this place? And he says, this can only be the gate to heaven, and this is the house of God. Now, what does he mean by that? I don't know. Right? But perhaps part of the astonishment is, like we're saying, why should a certain place be significant? God is not attached to any, he can't be related to any one place more than another. There's no relationship between something not physical, meaning God, and physical things, meaning the whole universe. I mean, there is significance in terms of events that took place. Like, for example, Maimonides says that the location of the altar that Solomon slaughtered on and that King David, his father, sacrificed on, and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Noah when he came out of the ark, and Adam upon his creation, it was the exact same location for all of them. And he says, and from that location, that is where Adam was created. Oh, so now we see, like we said earlier, we said that whenever some phenomena comes into existence, that defines it as its true significance. So what was the real significance of this location where all subsequent great leaders and prophets had sacrificed on? The original significance was that man was created at this location. So that's the concept of an altar, of a sacrifice, to show that we are created beings, and that really our existence is not mandatory. Our existence is only due to God's kindness. But really, we should not exist. That's what sacrifice means. You're showing something's dead. By proxy, really, this animal should be me. So you're demonstrating the concept of very, very fundamental of Judaism. Very big fundamental is that we must realize that we do not have to exist. And how do we demonstrate that we don't have to exist? We take an animal, we slaughter it. This is what we should be. We should be dead. We should be lifeless, without form, without life, without a soul. There's only God's kindness. But Adam was created at this point. So really, we are created. That's the real significance of the location. That's why all these great people wanted to sacrifice in the same location of where Adam was created. Because that really would embellish on the idea of what sacrifice is. Is to show that just like Adam was created and he didn't have to exist, nothing demanded the existence of human beings. Pure kindness of God. How do we demonstrate that and remind ourselves of that? The altar, sacrifice. That's why Maimonides says the altar had a very exact spot, location. And everybody, all these great leaders, sacrificed in the very same location. It's a beautiful idea. So sacrifice, the primary concept, is to realize that we do not have to exist. How do we demonstrate that? We kill an animal, just like that's not existing anymore. That's what we should really be. There's no reason we have to exist. Very primary. All right, so any questions? It looks like you have to start going to Rabbi Moskowitz's class, right?
Yeah, they're going to cut us off here in a couple minutes.
All right.
Yeah. I'm trying to absorb everything, Rabbi.
Okay.
It's just so phenomenal. And the fact that it's a miracle we exist, it's a miracle that anything works, it's just, the whole thing is just such a big miracle. It's just so hard to comprehend all of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, we should wrap up here so you can get ready for the next class.
Yeah, okay, thank you so much. Be well, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, so we're on for next week, right? And Josh, you'll be calling in?
Yeah, Josh will be
calling in. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. All right, any questions, you know? Was that? I didn't hear that?
50-50 chance for Kahelis.
That's right, 50-50 chance for Kahelis next week. That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
And I think we're like in the chapter 2, verse 11, somewhere around there. Where he, after he... In Kahelis. So if we do it next week, if you want to just be prepared in case we do it. So it's chapter 2. And it's about verse 11 or 12 or 15, somewhere around there. Okay, so wish everybody a good week.
And good week.
Rabbi, thanks very much.
Okay, my pleasure, buddy.
Be well.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
Be well, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.